Hello, everyone. This is Alexandra Betters of GalacticConnection.com, and I just want to say that before I get started with this interview, it has been amazingly challenging. So I know that we're going to be sharing some very important information for the world to see, hear, and take heed of. Today, I have with me on location Louise Clark and Michael Tellinger. I'm sure all of you know about Michael Tellinger's work. He's just been a master at bringing forth all the ancient information about South Africa, the fact that this is the cradle of humanity with the stone circles and unfortunately the cattle kraals that they claim that they are and that they've bulldozed over millions of them, unfortunately. So today what I thought we would do is review a lot of the information that he has, some new information that he mentioned, right, on the phone. And I also really wanted to honor Louise's work because she's kind of the woman behind the man who's brought forward the Ubuntu movement. I think it's something that all of us really need to take consideration of because we are now at the time we have to take action. There's no more sitting back complaining about the dark. It's now time for us to create the world in which we really want to live within. The Ubuntu movement is without a doubt, I've read the documents, it is outstanding, the information and the work that they've put into this. I don't feel like it's getting enough coverage around the world, which is one of the reasons I was very motivated to come here today. I do want to make note, we are inside Michael's museum, and we do have our friendly trees making some up above, so if you hear a little scratch in the background, that's the reason why.
The weeping willows.
The weeping willows, which is my favorite tree. So anyway, thank you. It's been quite a morning, and I'm really honored that you guys are so patient.
Thank you.
Is there anything that you want to just kind of start out with as far as what is currently the hottest, latest thing that you feel is really prepping people for acknowledging how important South Africa is in the changes that are about to take place on this planet?
Well, as you said, more and more people are beginning to realize that this is finally representing the evidence of the cradle of humankind, the places that the first humans that we can really associate and resonate with most likely walked the earth, that were our original progenitors in probably the most basic and genetic, primal genetic way. And that information is now spreading rapidly around the world. But what is, for me, what is really attracting attention from around the world is the science and technology behind the stone circles and ancient technology that I have shared and somehow discovered is part of this ancient civilization. And that's attracting the attention of some really leading edge scientists, you know, people like Nassim Haramein and others who are very much in the shadows. I mean, Nassim is a big profile individual, but there are many other brilliant minds that are Nobel Prize laureates that are contacting me and interacting with me on a daily, almost on a daily basis, that have really taken a shine to this mind-blowing information that we're dealing with. Advanced technology, all to do with resonance, frequency, and silicon-based technology, basically.
Excellent.
Vortex technology, toroid field technology, and so forth. And that, you know, when I started here nearly 8 years ago, that was the last thing on my mind. I was still thinking, well, who were the people that built this, and where did they disappear to, and why did they live here? And suddenly it's changed completely, turned that upside down on its head. That's, it's not about the people that lived here, but the energy devices that were built here.
Yeah, definitely. Especially, we went to Adam's calendar yesterday in the mist. I literally felt like I had walked back in time and also into Ireland. I had never seen that part of South Africa before. And it was almost eerie. I mean, like, I knew I had been there before. It was just that feeling I had. But anyway, Michael reviewed the stones and the way in which they were set up. And I was wondering, just to start out with, can you go over a little bit more? I think the thing that people don't totally understand is how can that literally be a calendar that they track time with? Can you maybe go over that a little bit?
Yeah, so before I say that, we'll explain that, just, you know, to once again say that the calendar was discovered by Johann Heine in 2003. For 5 years, he tried to get it to the attention of the media and the academia and the universities with absolutely no response. And then late 2007, I met him, and he showed me the calendar and the stone circles, and I immediately realized that that is what I wrote about in Slave Species of God.
Yes.
And that was automatically and inextricably connected to the information of the slave species and what I wrote about in that book. And so our journey of discovery began. Very quickly, Johann did the initial measurements and analyzing the calendar and realized it was actually still a functioning, or could be used as a functioning calendar, because the alignments are still pretty much in place. The one stone calendar receives the shadow of the calendar in front of it. Or let's turn that around. The one stone casts a shadow on the second stone. And you can tell every day of the year by the shadow of the setting sun. And it moves from the summer solstice through to the winter solstice and then back. So it is still and could be used as an accurate calendar if you drew the lines on it. It marks the equinoxes, the solstices, north-south. It passes right through the two central calendar stones. There's the Horus stone that marks on the eastern side, the rise of the sun. Next to it are the three stones that mark the rise of Orion's belt. And so it's deeply encoded with all this esoteric knowledge and connection to the stars that we seem to find with all ancient cultures. And here we have it. So once that was in place, that knowledge and information was in place, I started looking at, okay, well, why is it there? Who built it? And how is it connected to the stone circles? And that's when I went to visit Credo Mutua, and he told me, and the group of people that I was with, that he was initiated there in 1937 as a young shaman, and that it's a well-known and a sacred place of the African knowledge keepers and the shaman. And it's known as Inzalo Yalanga, or birthplace of the sun, where humanity was created by the gods.
It's so powerful.
So you can imagine when I heard him say this, it was like, in fact, it was preceded by me showing Credo a copy of my book, Adam's Calendar, which is sold out. We don't even have one single copy left anywhere.
You've got to do something about that.
Yes. But the thing is, you need money to print more books, so first we have to raise some money.
Because there's a hint.
The thing is that
we need help.
What some people don't realize is that all the money that we get from the book sales is going into the Ubuntu movement and just setting up this community of abundance. So every cent we have from the book sales goes in here. So when it comes to printing more books, it's not as if we're keeping the money to print more books.
Oh, no. And trust me, everybody, I've been walking around their, what do you call this?
This is the Ubuntu head office.
Head office, okay. And it is so cool. I mean, they have a library here. They have a restaurant here. They have a little hangout place for coffee and tea. They have a museum in the other room, which is really cool. He's got all kinds of really, really cool stones. And we can show you. I know a lot of people have seen you ring the bell of your stones. But tell me again, yesterday you and I were talking about how we thought it was very interesting that there was a white line down that center stone.
Oh, yeah.
So what do you think that was about?
That's the first time I've actually seen it. And it looks like the lichen, that one specific type of lichen is growing up right through the middle of the center stone. And I guess it's got something to do with the energy in the stones, because there's a vortex of electromagnetic vortex that goes out, it travels out of the ground into the sky. We haven't even touched that. So now we're jumping around a bit. You say, what? Okay, we need to get back to that maybe at a later stage to explain the energies and what we measured at Adam's calendar, that it actually is a very powerful energetic device. In fact, I believe it's probably the most powerful energetic device ever found and measured on this planet. To date.
I agree.
They might be more powerful, but we don't know about them yet.
Yes.
This one, at this stage, we've measured more than 400,000 375 gigahertz of sound coming out of the center of Adam's calendar. Now again, why is it called Adam's calendar? Because when Johann Heine found it, it didn't have a name, so we just called it the calendar. Then I called it Adam's calendar because I instinctively knew it was connected to the origins of humankind somehow. And then Kreta Mutwa told us it's called the Inzalo Yelanga, or birthplace of the sun. And the sun, not just as in S-U-N, but S-S-O-N as well. Okay, so
interesting.
There's an interesting play on words there, possibly.
Well, you know, we also talked yesterday about the fact that I really agree with you, because I did some work there yesterday that was pretty mind-blowing. And one of the messages that came into me was this truly was a program that was established around the world that was mentally, literally looping the thought process, we are a slave. We are the follower. We can't make decisions on our own. You know, we are subservient. We are unworthy. I mean, I was just feeling that the whole time I was doing my ceremony. And then you mentioned, without you and I really talking a lot of details, you said, yeah, somebody told me that this was actually associated with the grid around the planet. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, bam, you know, messages started coming in. It was like, oh, so that's why I'm here. So I really do believe that it was not necessarily a beneficial thing for humankind.
No.
Yeah, not at all.
No, and I think this is where a lot of people get it very wrong. And a lot of new agey, spiritual kind of bunny-hugging, you know, kind of people who are tree-hugging and bunny-hugging, kind of New Age spiritual people. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people like that.
Yes.
You know, oh, it's all love and peace. Well, you know what? It's not all love and peace out there. We are under attack.
Yes.
Every millisecond of every day. And that's what we got to realize. We got to stand strong. We can't just all be, oh, it's okay, everything is beautiful. No, that's part of the trap. And this is actually what Louise has been very vocal and very strong about, is that we've got to stand our ground, and sometimes you have to be a warrior. I'll let Louise talk about this a bit. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Well, and Louise is very patiently just sitting here waiting for a moment to talk, but I also wanted everyone to know that she's got a very interesting background as well in journalism and media, and she has 3 children, which no one would ever realize that. But I would love for you to tell them the background that you've had, because this is such a perfect precursor to being one of the main proponents for the Ubuntu movement, where you lived on a rural farm, and you know there wasn't any electricity, and you were pumping your water. And tell me, how was that? What was it like to live like that?
Well, I think that it actually made who I am today. I grew up in Johannesburg, in suburbia, very normal, protected lifestyle. I went to university. I knew nothing about the world really, but I felt instinctively something was very, very seriously wrong.
Yeah.
And during my 20s and early 30s, I spent a lot of time traveling Africa, living on farms, connecting with the earth, getting a lot of spiritual downloads and information, and really being trained up, I think, in retrospect, now that I look back, for what I'm doing now.
So agree with that. I can totally relate to that.
Yeah.
So tell them a little bit about what you are doing. Because, you know, no offense to Michael, but everybody knows all about Michael. But they don't know much about Louise. So. And these guys are such a team, totally. I mean, you guys really, you definitely compliment one another.
Yeah, we do. And
aww, I got him to kiss her.
We work really closely together. I think I've said it before, Michael has the framework of Ubuntu, and I weave the strands of connecting people. I hold the space here, the community. Community is women's work. So the volunteer project, the stone circle, the home, the restaurants, I hold that aspect of it. We're getting more into the community projects now, which is something I'm dying to get into as well. Michael's leading that charge at the moment.
And it's not easy,
yeah,
as you know.
There's a lot of work.
And we need to get into the explanation. The difference between what we're doing here and what people think we're doing here, because
yes,
there's a huge misconception.
Yes, we will. We will get into that, I promise. That's one of the main things I want people to understand, so that they can work with you and even take your prototype and be a network across the world, because I really do see this spreading far and wide.
Yeah.
But in order to kind of stay on track, let's go back to the Adam's calendar.
Yeah.
So at the point of you researching, discovering, realizing that this was a calendar, was there any other information that came through as far as the device itself? Did you find out anything else as far as what do you think it's emitting?
Well, it was several years. You know, these things don't happen overnight.
No.
And also, you got to be really consciously for it.
Big time.
The messenger has to be ready to receive the message before you can share the message. In absolute confidence.
Very good point.
To the world.
Yes.
Because otherwise you get shot down so easily. And believe me, I know that from when I, 10 years ago in 2005, when I started talking about contributionism, the philosophy of Ubuntu contributions that we're now putting into practice. It took 10 years to get from thinking about it and starting to talk about it to now implementing it. It didn't happen overnight. So when people think, oh, what are you guys doing? How, you know, you just come up with this flaky kind of idea. No, it's taken a decade to put into place. And be brave enough and confident enough to stand on stage and talk about it. Because I did this in 2005, and boy, did I get shot down. It's so easy to shoot you down by naysayers and you know, the hecklers and so on, because they just, they, you know, the negative kind of people, they don't have anything better to do than always look for the bad things and the negative things, right?
I can relate. We did a similar type of project in 2007, but it wasn't the right time.
Yeah. So, I learned how to face that kind of thing, being shot down and realizing, oh, well, I don't know enough about this to stand up and talk about it. I must go and do more homework. But I still spoke about it, but, you know, on a low level. And I kept learning. And every time somebody said to me, well, how are you going to handle this? I said, well, I don't know. Let me go away and think about it. And that's why it took 10 years. So I processed pretty much every level of how a society without money would work. And now, you know, I mean, Louise knows, we travel the world, we talk about Ubuntu contributionism to the smartest minds and people you can imagine, and I have not been shot down yet.
Good.
Or no... Nothing,
fantastic.
No argument or no negative sentiment has collapsed the model yet.
Good.
Because it's not my model.
Right.
It's a universal model, yes. It's a cosmic model. But it took a while for me to internalize it. So the messenger has to be ready to take the message to the people.
Yeah.
But the important thing as well is that people everywhere resonate with us. You know, it's not like you're telling somebody something that you have to make them believe or convince them about. People automatically are resonating.
It's so much an intrinsic part of
it. It's so innate to who we are as humans.
Good point.
So
And that's exactly as Louise says, truth resonates.
Yeah.
The source resonance is within all of us. Yeah. And when you put it out there, it goes in through the eyes, the ears, all the sensory parts of our bodies. It goes straight into your DNA and it resonates with your DNA and your heart, and you go, whoa, something is happening. I'm hearing this for the first time, and it's moving me and shaking me, and I totally agree with what you're saying, but I don't know why.
Yeah.
Why am I agreeing so strongly?
And
that's what happens to people. You know, you don't know that thousands of emails we get, people just pouring their hearts out, how they found us and how they couldn't stop watching the videos, and how can they get involved and how can they spread the message,
and how they felt the same thing their whole lives.
So we don't have to convince anyone.
Right.
It's in our DNA.
Right.
So I don't even know where we started on this question or whatever, but truth resonates, and it's a lot easier now to take this message to the people than it was 10 years ago.
Well, and I think you're familiar with Deepak Chopra.
Yeah.
Sure. One of the things that I thought that he brought out that was so significant was he was saying that if you met someone, all you had to do was just be in their field, and you were immediately changed. You were never the same. Just being in the field of one individual.
Yes.
Now, that same thing applies with a thought. It also applies with a movement. And so can you imagine if we shared this with even those that we felt are asleep? All of our family members that we all complain about, you know, on the internet, just telling them the idea, because you're planting the seed. Mm-hmm. And that's really where we're at right now, is we're still trying to get the human population ready for this. There's some people that are ready, but you know, we truly are the pioneers, you know, setting the stage.
So I think we were talking about the research in Adam's calendar and how it impacted on taking the message and so forth.
Yes.
So what I'd like to do is just come back to that, because
of
the technology and the research into the stone circles in Adam's calendar, which is really what brought us to this point right here.
Yeah.
So we're in the heart of this giant, vast, ancient settlement. You've seen it. The museum is right next door to us here. And there are priceless items, the artifacts that go back 300,000 years that people would hold, but not hammer and chisel with, use Caesar technology and possibly laser technology, but most likely Caesar technology, because these guys did everything with sound.
Okay.
Caesar stands for sound amplified by stimulated emission of radiation, so Caesar, as opposed to laser, which is lasers light amplified by stimulated emission of radiation. And so with sound Caesar technology, you don't need clear crystals, because you're focusing sound. And this is really what these cone-shaped tools are all about that I speak about. So, and right next door, we got a whole display of these cone-shaped tools that were most likely used for that kind of technology, together with the torus stones, the toroid vortex-shaped stones. It was really when we started looking at the stone circles and realizing that, hold on, something is strange with them. There's no doors and entrances. There's more than 10 million of them. What's going on here? And then I started that day in clusters, and it was then that I realized that they emit all these weird energies, incredibly powerful sound frequencies, and those sound frequencies then create the electromagnetic fields inside the stone circles. So it's just like the Bible tells us, sound first, God said, let there be light, and out of the primordial source of resonance of the Creator comes everything in creation. So same here. The sound comes out of the earth, the stone walls amplify it, create these electromagnetic fields, and now we got some powerful energy devices that are used for, we don't yet know what it was used for. Most likely for gold production, gold mining, manipulating the weather, the atmosphere, atmosphere creation, and so forth.
You know, I got a hit on this, by the way. One of the things that came in was the actual sound frequency that was emitted from the various stone circles were actually a letter or a signpost of that particular family.
Yes.
Because at that time, they were actually walking in and out of the walls. Mm. So they didn't really necessarily need doors and windows and that kind of thing. That was one of the things. The other thing was that the sound can also represent the trade that they actually offered. So if they were a silversmith or a doctor, you know, that they would resonate that sound frequency. It's a very different way of thinking than the way we are now. But isn't it also fascinating, the timing on this? Because now, when did you first discover the stone circles?
Well, I came to first see them in 2007, but the first written record of the stone circles goes back to the late 1400s.
Yeah.
So it's taken 500 years to decode them.
It's amazing.
500 years to decode the meaning of these stone circles.
And it still hasn't been completed.
No, of course not.
I mean, but it's a big mystery.
At least now we're on the right track, or on a track that's leading to some advanced or... And it has no ending at the moment.
Right.
Because until now, until I realized that we're dealing with sound and technology, it was still thinking that these were dwellings for primitive people, migrating tribes that, you know, would... And so now that we can completely dispel and dismiss those very ignorant kind of theories and put this squarely on the table, it's undeniable, it's scientifically verifiable and... supportable, because we've done the scientific measurements and the tests, so no one can tell us, well, you're just making it up.
Right.
And that's probably why I haven't been interviewed on programs like Ancient Aliens, because I'm not saying it could have been, it possibly was. I said, this is what it was and still is.
Right.
And that's a little uncomfortable.
Now, what kind of stats are you getting inside the stone circles as far as the electromagnetic?
Well, as I said, the stone circles, and each one of the stone circles, remember, the reason why there are more than 10 million of them, but each one is completely unique,
okay.
is because each done circle is a cymatic pattern. Yes. Cymatic pattern of the sound frequency at that specific point. So you're quite right. It is like a letter, but it's the sound frequency representing the shape of the sound representing that specific spot. So yes, it's a key. Like, yeah. It's each stone circle is a note. It's a key, as in the key of A or the key of G or B flat. It's sound, all to do with sound and resonance. And now you've got millions of these all connected by the channels that share the energy that they're generating. And they generate the lowest frequencies we measured were, I think, 11.5, either 11 or 14.5 gigahertz. Gigahertz, I mean, that's just insane. That's the lowest frequency.
14 gigs.
Yeah, and the highest frequency in the stone circles was about 35 gigahertz. And then at Adam's calendar, that's, as I told you yesterday, it just shoots. I mean, it's beyond 375 gigahertz. Now, as far as I know, nothing in human history has been measured at those levels, specifically in nature.
Yes.
You know, you don't measure things in gigahertz in nature or basic primitive structures that emit those kind of frequencies.
Right, right.
It's not going to happen.
What determines how high of a reading you get?
Well, the frequency, the resonance of it.
But does it have anything to do with the actual shape of the stones, the pattern of the stones? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it would.
It's
it would.
All of that. Yeah, all of that more,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
So now at Adam's calendar, just to explain, it seems like Adam's calendar was like the flagship, and that was receiving all the energy from all these clusters of energy-generating devices. These stone circles clustered together would generate all this energy and then beam it to Adam's calendar. And that's why it's so much more powerful. And it seems to still be receiving all that energy. That's even though we had these stone circles scattered all over Southern Africa, and they seem these like these benign stone structures, they're still alive. Because we've measured them. We know they're alive. And that Adam's calendar seems to have been one of these devices, like I've shown the temples of Egypt, actually not temples, but templates for computer chips, circuit boards, giant circuit boards, silicon-based technology that were generating energy fields that were keeping this energy grid around the Earth.
We have to get into that.
Right.
We have to get into that. I mean, and
Adam's calendar was one of those devices, and probably a lot more.
That's amazing. The other question I wanted to ask you was, when you are traveling around South Africa, I know you're continuing to find more and more. For example, yesterday we had lunch in your little town here, and I looked out and, you know, did a double look, and I saw stone circles.
Yes.
And I was like, my God, they're everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere.
So are you continuing to find more? I think the last time you said you had found over 100,000 of them, right?
Well,
now you were even up to a million or something crazy.
Yeah, there's more than 10 million.
10 million.
10 million that I counted. But that was by studying aerial photographs and Google Earth and
so it's easier,
and doing statistical projections. Yeah, counting how many are there per square kilometer, and then how many are there per hectare, and how many per 100 square meters, and then getting an average, and then finding the clusters where they are. By looking at Google Earth, oh wow, there's a huge cluster over there. And then using those averages to then add them up and go, I mean, when I did those calculations, I kept thinking I was making a mistake. And I went over it several times and I realized I wasn't making a mistake. That's completely mind-blowing. But where it gets, you know, where it gets even more exciting, now that when I saw Louise and I were together, when we had this recognition, we both looked at these aerial photographs of these, you know, ancient monuments and ancient temples. We were visiting some friends in Johannesburg, and next to the bed was this very rare book of aerial photography of ancient sites.
Ooh, I'd like to see that.
Yeah. And we started looking at this, and suddenly realized, oh my goodness. I said to Louise, look, can you see what I see? And so these are bloody computer chip circuit boards. That's what these things are.
It blew my mind. We were talking about the shapes of the temples, and we could not figure out why they had built so many pillars on the temples. And that was a big hit for me when you brought that forth, you know, that it was actually a chip. Now, do you were mentioning that it's taking advantage of the energies from the people that's being fed from the amphitheaters up through the road into the temple. Do you also think that it's taking advantage of energy signatures from planet Earth?
Most likely, yes. As I've mentioned in some of our presentations, you find the like the Acropolis and various other ancient sites. There's the Acropolis, the giant computer chip, right? Circuit board, and then attached to it is this amphitheater. And then over there is another amphitheater, actually two amphitheaters attached to the Acropolis. There might be more that have been broken down that we don't know about. So it looks like they put a bunch of people into the amphitheaters, got them excited to make a noise, and then the human sound, and that carries a very specific energy with it, right? It's human energy, it's emotion, it's anger, it's fear, it's all that kind of stuff, laughter, whatever it is, that energy gets channeled up to the mountain, to the circuit board. So the human energy could have possibly been the starter or the activator to get this thing to work. And once it works, it's possibly a self-perpetuating device. You just needed to start it and then every now and then come back and recharge it by putting people in there again. So, and that energy, I guess, was used as the energy grid around the Earth as the enslavement, entrapment grid.
So it's reinforcing all the other grids that they built.
So we enslave ourselves with our own energy of unconsciousness.
Right.
It's interesting. Maybe it's that they needed the imprint of the human energy if that's what they were going to affect.
Yes.
So maybe they would imprint the human energy to start up the device and then manipulate it in order to control us.
Oh, I would imagine so. I always go back to, you know, feeding the lions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, why is that?
It's like, what kind of energies are you extracting from that experience?
And that's all fear. It's fear-based energy. Fear of the authorities. Fear. And guess what's happening today? Most of the global population still lives in fear. Every day. Mm-hmm. People fear death. They fear disease. They fear losing their job. Fear their children getting run over, fear not having enough food, fear, fear, fear. Everything is fear. And obviously the media is the main protagonist of the promoting the fear factor, and it's just insane. And it's just intensifying. The more people live in misery and under stress. But again, you can only push people so far.
Yeah. Once it's starting to turn. Yeah. It's definitely starting to turn, which is the purpose of this interview today.
There is really a point where people say, that's it. Well, we can't be pushed any further. I have nothing left to lose, so screw this. What are we going to do to change this? And I think that's where we are, right here.
I agree. Now, I'm going to turn the tables on you a little bit, because you had mentioned that you had a father that was Ukrainian.
Yeah, my father was born in the Ukraine, yeah.
How do you feel that that's affected the way in which you've gone down the path of ancient history and stone circles, and bringing all this information forward? Did it have any kind of impact, you know, coming from those types of roots?
I'm not sure. I guess it must have an effect on me. It must have had an effect on me. I know that my grandfather was an amazing, incredibly resilient, probably revolutionary, if you want to call him that. He was a farmer in the Ukraine. And you know, the Ukrainians were just completely exploited and devastated by Stalin during the Second World War. All the farmers were pretty much rounded up and marched up to Siberia, and my grandfather was one of those. And he told me, before he died at the age of 98, he told me that there were 3,000 farmers and people that were rounded up by the Soviet Stalin army. At the beginning of the war, and marched for 3,000 miles. And from 3,000 people, or something like that, only about 30 arrived. There's a lot of threes in there, and it's very interesting.
Yes.
Only about 30 of them arrived alive, and he was one of them.
Wow.
And he worked in the snow concentration camps in Siberia for a while. I don't know how long he was there for, and one day just decided he's going to get out of there, and managed to escape. I'm not going to go into details, but it's a horrific story how he escaped and what happened. And so he was, and I guess I picked up some of that
fire.
Because I have a skin as very, very thick skin.
Yes.
Nothing really upsets me. I might get a little rattled and then maybe ask Louise.
Yeah.
And I don't hold grudges. I really don't hold grudges against anybody. Even people that really do me harm, I feel sadness for them. I want them to change their way.
Yes.
Shouldn't want to do anybody harm.
Right. And unfortunately for a lot of the high-profile people like ourselves, we are definitely, you know, being targeted these days in these final hours of
desperation.
The
wheat
from the chaff, as
yeah.
they say.
Mm-hmm.
So all you can do is just take the higher path and hope and know that people are really coming into their own intuition. They're trusting their own messages. You know, this is a time that we have to go within. It's not about going outside of yourself anymore. It really isn't. But anyway, I wanted to know if they can see this, but I'm not sure. You had also written this book, as you mentioned, The Slave Species of God, and you were talking about the evidence of the human origins, and I know that 97% of all the DNA is being proven to come from the stars, so to speak. So what other information can you share with us on that?
I don't think the DNA issue has now sort of, I guess, become a it's not even questionable anymore, because there's
right.
so many great geneticists that have come out and shared, you know, our DNA is not from here.
Right.
Most of our DNA comes from elsewhere. There are huge gaps and anomalies in our DNA. It's like somebody took a piece out and put something else in there. It doesn't even belong there. And so it's, you know, it is so obvious what's going on here. If anyone has still got problems with that, then they haven't done their research. And they still believe in the dogma that's been shoved down our throats for, you know, 60 years now, 70 years about the DNA, or 100 years, however long the DNA, the bigger talk of eugenics and genetics has been around.
Yes.
Not just Watson and Crick, you know, DNA, discovery, double helix, but it goes back further in time. Even in the Quran, I mean, in the Quran, they talk about about the DNA. They actually describe the DNA, about the creation of how the gods created us, and not God, in the Quran. And then one of my favorite descriptions about the creation of the human race comes from the Sumerian texts. When they talk about, they refer to DNA as the entwined essence.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they refer to the DNA, which is a far more eloquent description of what the DNA is, the entwined essence of the being.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
So we have DNA. What the hell is DNA? It's some weird, crazy, nonsensical, modern scientific name, just like they do, call things names that we can't resonate with or don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
If you call something the entwined essence, people will have a much better understanding of what it is.
Well, this is Michael's book, in case anybody hasn't read it.
So with the entwined essence on the cover.
Yeah, in red and green.
Yeah.
The Slave Species of God. Great book. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about, this is you had also mentioned something about they're coming up with more and more discoveries about how many planets are actually in our solar system, which should be giving us a clue to expand our way of seeing the Earth within the solar system, within the galaxy, within the universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have you come across any other information or evidence on that?
I sort of stopped following the planetary exploration several years ago, because I realized whatever information they're feeding us is not necessarily the truth.
Exactly.
So, you know, you get all excited about, oh, they discovered another planet. Well, you know, it's probably just BS. It's just something they want to spoon feed us to create a bit of excitement, but it's actually probably a deception. Because anything that comes through the mainstream media or the main scientific journals is all just part of the control mechanism. So
right.
Really what people need to realize is that the planets in our solar system, there are many, many more. We only know about a fraction of them. Most of the planets are not necessarily on the same orbit or the same plane of orbit.
I was just going to tell you, the fact that we've been taught of the planets that are supposed to be in our solar system, which are not,
yeah.
You know, a lot of that is a misnomer as well.
But it goes, you know, it goes even further than that. I remember when I was writing Slave Species of God, New Scientist, the cover issue of New Scientist was was how many planets in our solar system, and they had a 9 scratched out and 36 written above it, you know. So that was just a hint of telling us it's much bigger and much wilder than we can imagine. Okay. You know, you can replace a 36 with any number you want to make up, quite frankly.
Yeah, no kidding. And you're really big about bringing out mythology.
Yeah.
And, you know, what is the difference between that and history?
Exactly.
Can you tell us a little more about how has that changed your way of seeing things?
Well,
just having that realization.
Don't you love the fact that we call things mythology?
Yes.
And we say, well, these are just dumb people. Yeah. Dumb people from the past. They didn't understand lightning and thunder. They didn't know that it was a natural phenomenon. Really? And these are people like Plato and really smart people and scientists and astronomers from the past that didn't know what lightning was. They couldn't make a difference between a flying object that comes down from the sky and lands and beings come out of it, or they couldn't difference between that and thunder and lightning bolts. Who are you trying to kid? Are you kidding yourself? So the thing about mythology is, like, you know, the Greeks write about their gods, the Sumerians, all these ancient cultures talk about the gods. All ancient cultures tell us that we come from the stars, every single one of them. Not most of them, every single one of them. And so you got to say, is that something we should pay attention to? Yes.
Now this is an interesting question. Don't you think it's quite pondering to take the word God and the word gold?
Yeah.
And the only thing lot different is the L.
Yes.
Now there are people that have put information out about the L, which are a not so nice group of entities that have been wanting to enslave humanity.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? Well, gold versus God.
That's exactly. If you take the L out of gold, you get God or gods. And so let's just look at that. The Elohim. Michal Lidwith made a huge discovery when he realized that the opening phrase of the Hebrew Bible is missing the obligatory aleph at the beginning of the phrase. Okay.
Wow.
When you insert the aleph, and I've tried to memorize the Hebrew text, and I got very close to it, but I haven't recited it for a while now, so it escapes me now. But I showed in my presentations, I even have Michal's personal handwriting from when we were in Washington recently, where he, over breakfast, wrote it on a napkin for us. The Hebrew text and inserted the omissions and how it changes the text. And basically, if you add the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which is Aleph, and all sacred texts in Hebrew have to start with the letter Aleph, the first letter of the alphabet. Otherwise, you know that someone's messed with it. And that changes it completely. And in fact, not only changes the meaning, it corrects the meaning, because the way the current opening of the Hebrew Bible is, it doesn't make any sense. There's a confusion between Elohim, and Elohim is a plural word for El. El is a singular, Elohim is a plural, the gods. So it doesn't make any sense. Only when you add a left to it, now it suddenly says, it now means, it reads the following. Instead of saying, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, it now says, the Father of the beginnings created the Elohim, the heavens and the earth. And you realize that the Elohim are a bunch of beings or gods, they will come from the same source as everything else in creation. And then those beings and very high conscious individuals then assert themselves and could be called the fallen angels or some of them. And that's where you start seeing the separation of consciousness. And it's a complex issue, this.
I had to share this with you. This came in a couple days ago. It was another message. And I looked at a Dhamma. So it's A-D-A-M-A. And then I looked at the Lulu, L-U-L-U. And I noticed that Da was father, Ma was mother, A was the child, okay? Because it was the A's. And it was the creation. The A is the creation of the mother and the father.
Mm.
Okay? Then Lulu, this blew my mind, they basically said that the reason that they were called the Lulu is because the U was basically considered a well. It's considered something to store. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then they said the L was actually on top of the U. which closed it down and oppressed it so that there was no opening. And I thought, wow, it's very interesting. Because everything's been, in my work here in the last 2 months, everything's been going back to the Lulu. The enslavement of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, which world age do you think that this came out of?
Well, just for the people that watching this that don't know the word Lulu, the Sumerian text, and this is Summer Sitchin's explanation as well, Lulu, Amelu, or the primitive worker. And so it goes back to the Sumerian text and the Anunnaki gods, the Anunnaki, and people that follow some of the detractors that say, oh, the Sumerian texts don't say anything about Anunnaki. Really? Have you looked at the Sumerian texts? Every bloody sentence almost talks about the Anunnaki gods.
Yes.
It's like you can't get away from it. Enlil and Enki and Nin and all those names that Sitchin talks about, they're just full of it. And Anunnaki gods are just there everywhere. And the El as well are in there. So the Lulu Amelu, the primitive worker, is key. And that's why I think there's so many names with the word Lulu in.
Big time.
Yeah.
Big time. So what is your opinion after all of this research regarding the Ark of the Covenant? What do you feel is the ultimate purpose of the Ark of the Covenant? Just from everything you've studied so far. I'm curious to hear it.
Whatever it was not a good thing. It was not a nice device. It was a device of manipulating, control, oppression. That's the sense that I get. It was used for all those purposes.
You have a
bit
on it, Louise?
Yeah, I've read up some things with Michael and don't know too much about it, but certainly seems to be one of the keys that are, you know, the whole system of control, the whole matrix of oppression.
I agree.
The reason I say this is because the whole obsession with gold and monatomic gold and the amount of physical and spiritual torture and suffering that has been inflicted on a planet and the species of that planet is unimaginable. And that kind of imposed torture, suffering, enslavement can only come from a lower consciousness entity.
Mm-hmm. That's very well put.
So the problem is that because we have the highest source code that is connects us to the primordial source of all things encoded in us, that makes us, puts us in dissonance with the oppression that is imposed on us of the human race, the species.
Mm-hmm.
We have the source code in us. We want to be beautiful and express our divine, primordial, creative expression in our existence on this planet, but that has been suppressed. So that is, it's like separating God from God itself.
Yeah, from its own particle.
Yes. And this is why humanity is such a grief and strife and confused species, because we haven't been allowed through this oppression to awaken, to become enlightened. But no matter what they've tried, whoever they are, these Elohim or the Anunnaki or whatever other beings that are trying to keep this planet as a prison planet, no matter what they do, they can't stop the rise of consciousness, because that is connected to the primordial source code. And it's in us. So it seems like every few thousand years, something dramatic happens that sets humanity back into like completely dark age mentality, and it's like we have to restart again. However, I think we've now gone past that. This time around, the 2012 prophecy was therefore such a powerful prophecy, because they knew that after 2012, we can't go back to that dark age way of thinking. Yeah. So we're out of the loop, out of the slave loop, and now we're on the track to ascension, moving towards reunification with consciousness and the source code. And it is a huge subject. I'm not claiming for 1 second I know the answers. but I resonate with where we're going and what we should be doing to continue on this track. And the Ubuntu movement has got everything to do with that source code and the resonance and the unity with that source code. That's why it says, unity and high consciousness for a new world.
Yeah. In fact, the other thing that you were mentioning really resonates with me, and that is when we read all of this material about the oppression and the enslavement and all this stuff, do we ever stop for one moment to wonder why the humans, mm-hmm. why humanity?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's not just about God. It's about the fact that we are about as close of a representation of God, of, you know, from what I've been told by other people that have done some research or have received a lot of divine information, we're one of the most unique species because we can experience emotion from one side of the Richter scale to the other.
Yeah.
And nobody else can. And none of these other ET races, which I personally feel the darker ET races are very small, minuscule amount that's out there. And they're typically in cahoots with the government. They can't duplicate that.
Mm.
Nor can they absorb that. No matter how much they're going to splice and dice our DNA and, you know, do all these tests and everything else, which gets back to Anki's temple, you know, it gets back to Adam's calendar, you know, all of that. It ultimately always gets back to the DNA, which then gets back to the gold and the non-atomic capabilities of teleportation, freedom, just being able to go from here to there, which is our birthright.
Absolutely.
Is to be completely free,
mm-hmm.
and have no oppression, no enslavement.
Mm-hmm. And choose to be on a planet that we choose to be,
yes.
for all the right reasons.
Yes.
But then again, then that's why so many of them, those that have reached enlightenment,
yes.
choose to come back to do this work,
yes.
to help speed up the enlightenment.
Big time.
And that's so this is what a lot of people don't understand, again and again. The, you know, spiritual people, newly born, reborn spiritualists, are just like reborn Christians, right? There's very little difference. They discover this thing of spirituality and God and source and unity and love and all this, and they become just like reborn Christians. They want to run out there and tell everyone, but they don't have enough information. They're like little babies, and they often do and say the wrong things. And it's great, but just temper your enthusiasm a little bit, because you might just put other people up. First, be calm and collected and really internalize this before
it's
you go.
It's the process. It's such the process,
yeah.
for everyone out there. But I do want to reiterate, I mean, that's probably one of the biggest things I see, and I know you guys do, too, with the emails that I receive, is if you are feeling unworthy, if you are feeling you have no gifts, or if you're feeling that you do not have what it takes to be where you want to be, that's not your stuff.
Oh,
that's programming that you need to get rid of, period.
What we've really got to remember is that we have all the keys within us. We can do or create absolutely anything.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's just recognizing that makes us more able to project and to create,
yes.
you know, and we need to co-create as well. So just remembering that we have everything within us. We are gods. We are connected to the divine source. So simply, once we know and recognize that within ourselves and each other, we don't need to know anything else more than that, really.
But once again, see, this is important information, but if you take this and from a lower perspective or level of consciousness, and if you say this to someone, we are divine gods, they're going to go, what do you want, make me a mountain? No, it's like, okay, remember, we are, the divine encoding is in us, it's in our DNA. In fact, Enki did that.
Mm-hmm.
Enki encoded us with it, because he knew that he was a smart guy, and is a smart guy, because he seems to be a higher, multi-dimensional, high-conscious being,
yes.
that was doing stuff here that, for certain reasons that we don't understand,
right.
on many different levels, not
still
just for...
Still don't have a lot of information on them.
Exactly.
Really
what I do understand is that both Enki and Enlil were doing stuff that That was, we don't understand it. But anyway, the thing that Enki did, he encoded us with all this information. The source code is in us.
Yes.
That's it. And he knew that if he didn't do that, he'd be breaching the prime directive.
Yes.
What is the prime directive? Is he's going against the prime resonance frequency of everything in creation.
Right.
You see, and this is really, once you start understanding that the resonance with source is everything. If you don't resonate with source, you are in dissonance. You are a cancer cell,
yes,
in all of creation. And you will be consumed and discarded to come and re-manifest yourself and see if you can continue resonating with a prime resonance source code. And if you don't, you'll be recycled again.
Right.
And so it goes. So no matter what these distractions are, and these dark beings and galaxies that are taken over by these draconian dark beings, in our perception, it's eternity, but it's not. It might be trillions of years, but it's still a drop in the ocean of infinity.
Right, right.
And the source code. And they too will be recycled because they're disease. They're not coherent with the source code.
I have to throw this out to you. There is a theory out there and a suggestion that basically each of the world ages occur because some of the beings that run the planet have access to the Ankh, use the Ankh, put everybody to sleep, and they start all over again. Now, why is that important? Because it's getting right involved in what you're doing, which is discovering the stone circles. And what do they say? What does an archaeologist always say? Always look to the ancient sites because it's going to be a building on top of another building, mm-hmm, on top of another ruin, on top of another structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then you get back to, well, God, what do we believe? Okay? It really puts a huge question mark on time,
mm-hmm,
which I was going to ask you about because I know that you and I talked about that a little bit yesterday. It's really confusing for people to look at Adam's calendar, which... What year were you thinking that is?
Well, the evidence suggests about 300,000 years.
I think it's a lot older than that.
Yeah. It could be. It's what's important to know is one of the things I didn't mention earlier is that Adam's calendar is, although it's aligned with the north, south, east, west cardinal points and the equinoxes and solstices, it is not aligned with true north and south. It is out by 3¼ degrees anti-clockwise. So it tells us that Adam's calendar was built at a time where true north, south, east, and west was not what it is today. So it was built before huge geophysical turbulence happened on planet Earth and then probably caused a mass extinction and a restarting of a whole planetary civilization. So that is a very important aspect about Adam's calendar and one of the most mystifying ingredients there.
Now talk to us a little bit about the first stone that we saw when we drove in.
Oh, right. The first,
I can't wait to see you talk about this.
The first stone, yeah. The first stone, what you call the stone man, which was removed from Adam's calendar in around 1992, and then 2 years later in 1994, they found it lying in the workshop of the plant, the forestry plantation. And they brought it out, and isn't that a miracle in itself?
Totally.
First of all, why did they take it out? Why did they decide to push over a random stone in the middle of nowhere and take it to the workshop in the forestry?
Yes.
Workshop. But that still, I don't understand. And
who did it?
Yeah, well, I know who did it. Yeah. I know. I heard about the guy that was driving the bulldozer or the front end loader that did it. I've been meaning to try and track him down, but I don't know if he's still alive.
And hopefully he's not going to be found by Michael.
Yeah. No, but I wanted to ask you, like, who told you to do that?
Yeah.
You know, who gave you the instructions to take that stone out? And was there a reason why they wanted to take that particular stone out? And then why did they make you take it to the workshop? And in any case, 2 years later, miraculously, that stone was brought back into the nature reserve when they were declaring the nature reserve open as a blue swallow nature reserve. That particular stone, closer to Adam's calendar where it was removed from. That's just insane.
Bizarre.
The coincidence is there. And but the Credo Number 12 speaks about it as the clitoris of Mother Earth. Clitoris of Mother Earth. Now, what do clitorises do? They vibrate. They resonate. they create very, very high energy and frequency within the body that they reside in. And that's exactly what the stone man or the clitoris of Mother Earth did at Adam's calendar. It was the resonator or the vibrating stone, and I believe it was the receiver of all the frequencies and the energies from all the other stones, stone ruins and the clusters, as I mentioned before. That vibration of the stone man was the activation for the two central stones, which are like two metal plates that then vibrate and create the very powerful energetic fields.
Where do you think it was?
What?
The stone man.
Stone man. It was right there where I showed you in the hole that it was taken out. The hole is still there that it was taken out. Right on the edge of the circle.
Okay.
Aligned with the Horus stone on the other side. So the stone man was on the west side, the stones, the two calendar stones in the middle, and then the Horus stone on the eastern side. So the sun comes across like this on the equinox.
So you have the Horus on the east side,
the calendar stone, and then the shadows.
So what do you think she, who do you think she was?
Yeah.
That's an interesting.
Exactly.
Somebody dive in and look at that one.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned that gold can travel around the universe. In your one of your, I believe it was in the slave species material.
I'm not sure in what context I was referring to that, so I'm a little fuzzy on that. But the reason I brought, when we were talking about the monatomic gold and the obsession of the gods, you know, the Elohim, you take the L out of gold, it becomes God or the gods, and you see these interesting connections. The thing is that that's all lower consciousness stuff. If you connect it to source, you don't need anything.
Right.
You can experiment with these things.
Yeah.
Okay, so now this is... So in this physical form, as Louise was saying earlier, we say we're gods. We've got the God encoded, the God resonance encoded into us, but we operate in this density. Mm-hmm. And we've been so manipulated, and our brains have been suppressed, and our third eye has been manipulated, and so much more that we probably haven't even discovered in our bodies that have been manipulated. We can't manifest our thoughts in this state. We started to realize that we should be able to, and I guess there are many people that have risen to very high levels of consciousness and enlightenment that can do that, and there have been reports of people doing it. And that can move things or their objects and objects with their minds and levitate and do miraculous things and transmutate things by looking at them or chanting. So yes, clearly people can do that, but not everyone can do that.
Right.
And that's the problem.
Right.
But even if everyone could do that, right now at our level of consciousness, that would be chaos. That would be a mess.
Yeah.
It's like, I hate that person. I want him dead. You know, it's like, no, you can't have these source code abilities if you still... a lower level consciousness being.
And acting like a child.
Yes.
I mean, I forgot who it was. I think it was Sheldon Neidl. They were referring to humanity at this point. They were saying, you know, we're embryos compared to the rest of the universe. I mean, we're just in the big, we're in the small growth phase compared to where we're going. Michael, have you heard about the fact that all of the gold is being taken off world?
Yeah, of course. That's been one of the subjects that I have spoken about extensively and get asked a lot of questions at my workshops. It seems to still be going on.
Do you have any tidbits of profound information in that subject? To me, I feel like that's one of the biggest mysteries of all is, you know, who's removing it, why, where is it going, and is it ultimately to assist in this transitional period? Because maybe, like you said before, maybe we do need a little bit of assistance from monatomic gold to get the job done.
Yeah, well, the thing is that we're not benefiting from it. Humanity doesn't seem to be benefiting from it. The gold that we are left with is the shiny metal, heavy metal gold, and that's just no good to us here because it just caused wars, separation and conflict and theft and envy. Yeah. And so,
greed.
So whatever is going on with the gold is not good for this planet. Whoever is taking it off, whether it's the Anunnaki or other beings at this stage, that book is open. What it's being used for in its monatomic form or any other kind of form that it may exist, because we are only scratching the surface of infinite multi-level, multi-dimensional physics that we know fraction about. So however it has been used by other beings in creation, I can only speculate. I've heard a lot of theories on that, too many theories to go into right now, because it'll consume the entire conversation.
Yeah.
So all I want to say to people that are watching this and listening to this, if you think you've got this figured out, you're wrong.
I think it's like the newest, hottest discussion.
Yeah.
I really do.
But I would like to say, we should not be discussing that. We should be discussing, how do we move forward as a species? How do we... That's all delving in the past. What's happening to the goal? Blah, 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 blah. And I normally end my presentation for that, on the ancient ruins and civilizations and the monatomic gold and the good stuff and the bad stuff from the past, and say, great, exciting information. So what? Now what do we do with this knowledge and information? That's what we do with it.
Yeah.
We look at how do we solve our problems, how do we use this knowledge and take humanity into the future of unity consciousness, moving towards unity consciousness, towards creating a planet of abundance, because that's what it is, removing it from the planet of fear, removing it from the planet of slave mentality, people realizing that by working together in cooperation rather than competition, we will very quickly create a planet of abundance. And it really, in essence, is that simple. And that's what the Ubuntu movement and the philosophy of contributionism is all about. So it's all about learning as much as we can from all the stuff we've been talking about, and now moving into the future, saying we've got a blueprint that is unfallible. And as I mentioned right at the beginning, in the last 10 years now, I have not heard one comment, argument, or anyone shoot slings and arrows at the philosophy of contributionism has not collapsed it. In fact, every sling and arrow that I take makes it stronger, because it provides a new solution for a potential problem that we may not have addressed. And as I've been saying for a long time now, it's a self-correcting system. I don't correct it. The system itself corrects itself for the best outcome.
Absolutely.
Of the entire community.
Absolutely. And if you just... It's the same as an economy. If you just allow it to function naturally, it will automatically adjust itself.
Yeah, but you need to have the right foundation in place. I don't like to use the word economy, because it suggests we have to economize.
Yeah.
And the word economy is a tool of the banking elite.
Yeah.
So I try and eliminate the word economy from anything we talk about. Rather talk about abundance, creating communities of abundance where everything's available to everyone all the time. We don't have to ever think about economizing. That is a subset of capitalism, global elite, banking families. We have to economize. No.
Well,
we have to...
restrictive thinking. Anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, I know you really are chomping at the bit to get into Ubuntu, and I promise you we're going to, but I still want to cover a couple other things. You talked a lot about the Abzu.
Yeah.
Can you go over a little more? I think the reason I say that is, being an American and being here in South Africa has been a real wake-up call for me as far as what Abzu really is. It just seemed to put a lot of things in place for me. Mm-hmm. So if you could cover that, that would be... You know, where exactly on the map is Abzu?
Abzu is, for people who have been researching, it has many meanings, many connotations attached to it. One of them, which I believe is one of the most significant ones, and once again, you can dissect that word in many ways, Ab and Su, and connected to Enki and his activities, and it's connected to water and so much. But one of the frequently missed definitions is that it's the land below the equator where the gold comes from. And often it was described as Abzu is like hell, because below the equator, or it was like a line, the word equator,
underworld.
Yeah, the underworld. It was the underworld, so the land below the equator, which is the underworld. And then people misinterpreted that and think, oh, underworld, it must be hell. No, it's the lower part of the planet.
And that's where Enki ruled.
Well, this is it. This is right it. You know, everything about Adam's calendar is to do with Enki.
Yes.
Everything to do with Great Zimbabwe is to do with Enki. And then you extrapolate that line, 31 degrees east longitudinal line, from Adam's calendar, Great Zimbabwe, and you get to the Great Pyramid of Giza. So we have to assume that Giza has got something to do with Enki.
Yeah, I think so. That's a good
and Anunnaki. And again, this is the important thing. We cannot underestimate the importance and the influence of the Anunnaki on this planet, our solar system, our entire galaxy, and our entire universe, and beyond. And from some research and some teachings of other researchers, like people like Ashiana Dean,
yeah.
And I know, again, she's got many detractors, and people go, oh, no, no. But you know what? You got to read as much as you can.
The Voyager series is amazing.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
You got to take as much as you can out of all sources of knowledge and information and put it into context of what you already know. And where I can tell you what suddenly resonated with me is that the Anunnaki and what James Gilliland talks about as the primordial beings.
Yes.
She talks about both of them, the Anunnaki and these feline energies that seem to be the first energies that were created, like the primordial creative forces, the seven primordial...
The guardians,
exactly. The seven primordial frequencies out of which those beings came. And the Anunnaki go right back to that very, very ancient primordial creative moment. So they're not just a bunch of beings that are hovering around doing malicious things. We need to start looking at them very differently. And there's clearly been some sort of split. We can look at them as fallen. They possibly are part of the fallen angelics. It's a lot of possibilities that we're dealing with.
I think we all ponder as to how do we look at polarity these days.
Yeah.
How do we look at, you know, evil versus good and light versus dark? And where do we come to a place where we're still able to acknowledge that we created all of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
To a large degree is a distraction.
Yes. Even though we have been enslaved, mm-hmm. even though a lot of this has been put upon us as a yoke,
yeah.
you know, we still have to take some accountability for
yeah.
why did we come here? In the very, 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 very first place. Mm-hmm. That's where I always go back to.
Yes.
Yeah, it's. I find what you're saying is great for conscious people.
Yeah.
Unconscious people say, we got to take accountability. Well, I've got nothing to do with this. I was born in New York. What do you mean? Accountability? You know, it's really important.
You were born way past
yeah.
New York.
Yeah. So, you know, how do you mean I must take accountability? I've got nothing to do with this stuff. Well, see, that's the... Unfortunately, we got to take those people, those children of lower consciousness
yes.
that still think along those lines and say... Okay, come, let's show you the bigger picture and bring you into the beautiful story of humanity, the beautiful story of creation in which you were a co-creator and somehow landed up in this thing. However, and again, we cannot also, like I said, cannot underestimate the influence of the Anunnaki. We must also, like Louise said, do not underestimate those dark and negative forces. Whatever, I hate using the word dark and negative because it puts a thing on it, so... The forces that are trying to suppress
the suppressing forces.
Humanity, the suppressing forces that are working in antithesis towards unity consciousness, the opposing
yeah, freedom
and total free will.
Yes,
you know, and what is happening and why they're doing that on this planet, and that's where you see the very distinct separation and these polarities moving apart, and that's a very again very confusing subject.
I know, if we could go on. Now, I want to read this. This came out in your book, and it was so profound. I'd like to, and maybe you might want to comment on this as well. No one knows where Great Zimbabwe came from and why it's there. Quote, where the bowels of the earth to enter, place of deepness he determined, for the heroes into earth's bowels to descend, unquote. That came from the Sumerian tablets, as you know.
Yeah.
That can be interpreted quite a few different ways.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Especially the part about the heroes into Earth's bowels to descent.
Well, as you just said, it could be interpreted in many ways. I've been interpreting it in the one way as creating the gold mining empire here, to be able to dig mine shafts where they went into these mine shafts to extract the gold and the gold-bearing ore out of the earth and then process it and get the gold out of it. But it could mean a lot of other things too.
Because I was thinking, if they're talking about the bowels, which would be maybe the lower third of the earth, then yeah. we're talking Anki's territory, that could be one. The other thing that a lot of people are talking about is ascension, ascension, or is it descension, where you're becoming in union once again with your own mother, with your own womb, with your own heart, love, divine energy, okay? So we're actually descending, because if you think about, they're talking about Mother Earth is finally going to release herself and be free of the mantle, because we're one of the very few planets that have beings living on the outside of life.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that, Louise?
I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. I always find all of this, it always pertains again to who we are and where we are. We can always use everything that we read and see as a lesson or as a point of growth of
ourselves.
Right.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Louise often says most of the things in our lives are a distraction. And the more time I spend with her, the more I realize that that's really the lifestyle, everything we're doing on this planet right now is a consequence of the slave species being totally controlled. So yes, everything is a distraction. We think that cell phones and computers and smartphones and this and touch screen stuff is advanced technology. It's a distraction. It's bells and whistles.
We are advanced technology.
Yes.
We are free energy.
Good point.
And we should stop wasting our time looking for the solution. The solution is within us.
Yeah.
And again, if people say, what do you mean by the solution is within us? We have the source code. The source code is the source for creating everything. So by looking, thinking, speaking, imagining, we should be able to manifest everything imaginable. The Green Lantern, the movie, is a great example of that.
Yep.
Okay, and you just think and manifest and create it instantly as you go. That's actually a great movie to maybe show people to go and see the Green Lantern, that you can just manifest and create things instantly with your mind. We don't need heaters, we don't need free energy devices, we don't need shelter, we don't need anything. We are the free energy devices because the source code is in us.
It's very similar to that movie Lucy that's just come out recently. You've got to see that as well. Very interesting.
Well, and I would say most people would say, yeah, well, that's great for you. You know, you've gotten to a state of consciousness where you're capable of manifesting.
We are all capable. We all have the DNA within us. And that's the thing I often tell my people. If we don't tell people that they are gods, that they have this capability, it's the same as oppressing them. People have to start thinking and hearing that they have such potential within themselves.
And it's like anything else. You, when you're a skinny little runt, you don't walk into the gym and walk out a beefcake, right? you go to the gym and you spend a few months and you come out a beefcake. It's the same thing with consciousness and manifesting. We're in a very thick 3D density here.
Very. The thickest out there.
Yes, although we want to manifest, it's going to take you to practice. This is why teachers of high consciousness and enlightenment and so forth will tell you, and they'll teach you that you must do that every day. It's an exercise. And I'm not saying you must go and sit down and meditate and do mantras and all that, because that, if you don't know what you're doing, that could be dangerous too.
A distraction
as well. Just think about it. Say, right, I manifest for myself this. And if you do that every day, that's your exercise. That's your gym workout every day. Even if you do it for 30 seconds or 60 seconds a day, say, today I'm going to do this. I'm going to have the short-term goals, medium-term goals, your long-term goals, and do it every day. Practice every day and manifest this. Say, I need this, I need that. We need this to achieve this.
Feel it.
Say it.
Be it.
Take a glass of water. Drink the water so you activate the water and do that with the water as well. Even if you think it's a silly ritual, and in the beginning it feels like a silly ritual, but just do it every day. This is your gym workout of consciousness.
Yeah, and it's real tough, you know.
And you get better at it. You get better
and it really becomes... I'm facetious when I say that.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I often tell people that just go find a stick. Go get a staff.
Yeah.
Create and imagine your own staff, like your Merlin or whomever. And put all of your light into slamming that into Mother Earth with your intention and your heart, and of course it needs to be in the highest. See, I think the way in which we are moving into manifestation now is we have to start thinking about all.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about what do I need,
it's co-creation.
It's all of us.
You know, I look at, I can only speak from my personal experience. I can't even speak for Louise's experience, although we're very close.
Yeah.
My personal experience is, in 2005, I realized that we have to start moving towards a world without money. Just imagine that simple little thought. In that little moment, I came up with a word called contributionism, where people contribute their God-given skills, or God-given talents, or their acquired skills because of their talents. Each one contributes those towards the greater benefit of all people in their community. Right? Then I realized that Ubuntu is actually the same ancient philosophy that, and Louise reminded me of it, and that's why it's called Ubuntu Contributions. But 10 years ago, I had this idea. Now, some people would have the idea and then let it go. And I realized, well, if I don't do something about it, no one's going to do anything about it. And I started talking about it, started manifesting it, and reciting, repeating it as often as I could to everyone I met. And unfortunately, you lose friends this way.
Yes.
Because they say, oh, Michael, you're so boring, you can't talk about anything else. That's all you can talk about.
That's
true. It is true. Yeah. But it's taken 10 years. I do have fun every now and then. Right? Not often enough. But it's through this 10-year manifestation. Look where we are today. We've taken that simple little thought. It's taken 10 years to get us to be here today. In this place that I bought with the income from the sale of my books.
Yeah.
It's
right on.
It is insane.
Good for you.
Right? So we've taken a simple little thought and grown and kept manifesting and keep reinserting and growing. And now it's almost that we think of we need this, we need that, we need, and within an hour or day or a week, we start manifesting it.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up because now it's time to go more heavily into the Ubuntu movement. And I really want Louise to just kind of kick this off with, where were you, what was it, 7 or 8 years ago, you said you kind of had a realization through all of your worldly travels of where you wanted to take this idea.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. It came as a little bit of a surprise to me. Like a lot of people, felt really sick with the way the world was. Didn't know what was the solution, but felt something was very seriously wrong. And I got an inspiration and a really strong calling to go and visit West Africa. And I went backpacking there with my partner and my 5-year-old daughter. And
what a great experience.
We ended up on the Niger River, and we were walking along through the black mud. And you know when you have these moments of clarity? Everything becomes still. I could hear the river, and there were women washing dishes, and it was kind of like a rhythm going.
Nice.
We were walking along this thick black mud, and the wind blew and said to me, time to create a new culture.
That's amazing.
And I was like, what was that? It said twice, time to create a new culture. And of course, everything fell into place because the reason I'd gone to West Africa was to escape my Western life of privilege. We were living on a very opulent racehorse stud farm, dining with the sheikhs of Dubai and the royal family. And it just didn't make sense. So we went to West Africa thinking we'd go back to our roots. And of course, Spirit reminded me saying, we can't go back, we've got to create new. And I became quite obsessed with this idea and started thinking about how do we create new culture? What are all the components? How do we do this? And thought a lot about that for many years. And then in 2010 when I met Michael, we kind of just realized we're on absolutely the same path.
It wasn't like a lightning bolt or anything?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah.
Yeah, we instantly connected, and this Ubuntu thing was the connection. Because I'd been, in my search for new culture, I'd been living with people in the Transkei in KwaZulu-Natal. I'd been working with people I could see Ubuntu in action. I didn't know it was called Ubuntu initially, but I could see this common communal thread among people where everybody just helps everybody else. And each person has a role that benefits the whole community. So I saw it in action long before I actually understood what it was. And Michael actually defined that in explaining his blueprints and contributionism to me, reminded me of all I'd learned from the African people about Ubuntu and what that means.
That's kind of the way the Bushmen live, right? And yeah, of course, absolutely. Our indigenous,
In fact, it's not only the Bushmen or the Native Americans. All of us come from that place.
Yeah.
And that's why I think people resonate so strongly with what we say now. Everybody resonates with Ubuntu.
The other thing that's beautiful about it is everyone has a gift.
Absolutely.
And it acknowledges everyone's gift so that no one feels left out.
Yes.
The interesting thing
each
is
each one is vital in actual fact.
Yeah.
And I love to, I always have this, sorry, interrupted
you. No.
But I always think of the world. We're all here. We all have a divine right to be here. And if you think about a globe or a web surrounding a web is held in place by each point. So if each person is a point, each person has to be strong and responsible and in their power in order for the web to be secure.
Very good.
So we need to activate all people. People all need to have their input and their gift and their light to shine, as we all do. We all have something to offer.
I totally agree. So where did it begin? How did you guys get this all first started? I mean, did you put pen to paper? Did you, what was the first thing you did? Did you go out and do seminars or try to recruit people? Where did you start your learning process?
Well, Louise and I met at one of my presentations.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Considering how much you travel.
I was writing an article on this work.
Ah.
Yeah, so she came to one of my presentations not far from her farm. It was out in the sticks, and I was doing a presentation in a private home near Hartbeespoort Dam in South Africa, and Louise came, and we just connected. And what was interesting is that what I just really wanted to pick up on what she said with the strands, and everyone has to be strong. And I just suddenly realized that how the Ubuntu movement. It really, we could never have imagined or projected this even a year ago. How now we've got members in more than 215 countries. I don't know how many it is now around the world that are following the Ubuntu movement. That each one really now is carrying that strand. So if you can think about, so the Ubuntu philosophy and the contributionist philosophy is now spread across the world already. And wherever there's someone holding that consciousness or that philosophy, we have a plug point into the earth grid consciousness.
Yeah.
So without us even, if I planned this, it's not possible.
Right.
It's happening organically.
Correct. And divinely.
And divinely, yeah.
I can answer that harder than begin. It began with Michael's Slave Species book. It moved on to his research, the Sumerian connection and his research of the stone circles here. The realization that we're an oppressed species, and then it comes full circle to Ubuntu. If we're oppressed, what are we going to do about it? And so in 2010, Michael started talking around the world about the stone circles here and his book Slave Species and a little bit more and more and more about Ubuntu, about the liberation, about what we're going to do about it.
Very exciting.
So that's how it started, and it really comes together so nicely, right?
Well, I was going to make that point that they still have to recognize first.
Absolutely.
That we are oppressed.
Yes.
Which is why we had to cover the historical value of it in the first place.
Exactly.
Because if they don't understand their past, then they're not going to be able to move through the future with that awareness.
Mm-hmm.
But, I'm just curious. So what was your next step? Did you go buy land? Did you, what did you guys do?
I was already living here.
You were already living here?
Yeah.
Okay. This is cool.
And,
I love this
place. And at that stage, my ex-partner and I were just moving apart. She wanted to do other things, and she felt like this was not really her calling, and that's what happened. And Louise just...
And that's okay.
And it was an immediate... It was like that door had to close and another one opened for Louise to enter this equation and me to enter her equation. And so she moved in here and started working on the what we call the Ubuntu Village and sorting it out, fixing it up, but it's taken a long time. It's not an easy path.
No. And it hasn't really been a plan. I mean,
yeah.
So you've kind of just, it's just whatever came up each day.
It's unfolding.
Just, and the reason I'm asking that is people are probably going to say, okay, I'm really into this, but where do I begin?
Yeah.
You know, how do I get started? And how much money am I going to need to get started, to start a different branch somewhere around the world?
It's an interesting thing because each community is different. Each community, in terms of geography, population, everything is different. Mm-hmm. Each community is different. So though you can have a blueprint, maybe of the philosophy, you almost can't state this, and you know, accept that Ubuntu needs people and people need to contribute with whatever that community needs.
Would you agree that this is actually one of the more difficult places to launch Ubuntu?
Probably the most difficult.
You know, just since I've been here, I mean, compared to where I come from, which is Southern California, where a lot of people are awake.
Yeah.
A lot of people.
Yeah, it's. I don't know how to answer that either. I don't know if it's easier or more difficult to launch here. This is where we are.
Yeah,
this is
you just got to do what you got to do.
And yeah. And what I can tell you is that 2 years ago, I was having sleepless nightmares about thinking, how are we going to unite this community? Because remember, we have 11 official languages in South Africa. So already the language problem is a problem.
Yeah.
So I can't just walk into a township where predominantly black South Africans live and they might speak, you know, Ndebele or Venda or Zulu or Siswati. And if I speak English, most of them won't understand me. So already we have a problem there. And I was thinking, well, how am I going to unite the people, being an English-speaking South African who never learned an African language, which is really a huge problem and something I'll always regret, and I'm trying now, anyway, jumping. So now, if I took you around the township now, around the town, wherever we'll go, you'll see people saying, Michael, Ubuntu, and I'm stunned at how easy it's been to unite the people of this town.
Fantastic.
And how quickly they are waking up and realizing that by working together, we will achieve miracles, and we will create the abundance that contributionism is all about.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to take a break here and get a little bit more into all the details of the Ubuntu movement. I know everybody's anxious to hear how can you start this movement in your hometown. So we'll be back in a few minutes.